We'll start, as always, with our look at what's in the papers this morning. A panel in studio to help me to that. Kevin Doyle, Group Political Editor at Independent Newspapers. Good morning to you, Kevin.
Morning, Gav.
Siobhan Masterson is the Head of Corporate Affairs at the Employers Group IBEC. Good morning to you, Siobhan.
Morning.
And Jim McGrath is a Public Affairs Director with Teneo Ireland and a former government advisor. Thanks to you, Jim, for coming in. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Thank you all for coming in to be with me this morning. Let's have a quick look at what's on the front pages of the paper, starting with the Sunday Independent. Ministers now fear carbon tax backlash, reports Philip Ryan, Deputy Political Editor, who tells that government ministers fear an angry backlash from rural voters when they significantly increase carbon taxes, which will push up the cost of petrol, diesel, heating oil and other fuels. Fine Gael cabinet ministers believe that the plan to hike carbon taxes by €6 to €7 per tonne could add an unnecessary financial burden on rural voters ahead of the fast approaching general election. Now, we made it two paragraphs in before they linked it to the election. Ministers are also concerned that Fianna Fáil will backtrack on its concern to, or on its decision to support the controversial climate action measure if the increases, which will add an extra €1.20 to the cost of an average tank of diesel or petrol, spark public anger. The hike also means that 900 litres of home heating oil may increase in price by between €15 and €16. A bale of briquettes could cost around 15 cent more, and a 40 kilos bag of coal could go up by more than 70 cent. It also says that Pascal Donohue is expected to delay the carbon tax hike on home heating oil and other fuels until May because of the increasing fears in government over the political impact of the extra burden on rural families. Delaying it until May, which is of course the month that Leo Varadkar wants the general election to be. So whether he's able to delay the political fallout by having a new tax coming in just as we go to the polls, who knows. Front page of the Sunday Times meanwhile, new British offer falls well short, says Varadkar. This is some comments made by Leo Varadkar at a Fine Gael event last night. We'll play you some audio of that in a little while, but he tells us that Boris Johnson's latest offer on Brexit doesn't represent enough progress to take negotiations into the intense final phase, the so-called tunnel. But Leo Varadkar also says his officials are currently trying to arrange a face-to-face meeting for him with the British Prime Minister this week. A deal is still possible at the European Council summit in 2 weeks' time, he says, but the current position is, as of today, that the EU, including Ireland, doesn't yet feel that the proposals put forward by the Prime Minister form the basis for deeper negotiations. But there's plenty of time for the UK government to put forward further proposals, and we're in the process of trying to arrange a meeting between me and the Prime Minister this week. John Mooney also has a report on the front page of the Sunday Times that the government is proposing setting up customs bases at key locations along the border to protect the EU single market if there is a no deal. But instead of having permanent checkpoints, mobile customs units operating from the bases would assume responsibility for patrolling the border crossings used to transport goods and animals, which might explain why so many of us have seen pictures on Twitter and doing the rounds this week of big fleets of newly branded customs cars going up the M1 towards the border region. Really interesting story in the front page of the Sunday Times by Norma Costello, who's been doing a lot of work on the fate of Lisa Smith, the member of the Air Corps. She says that photographs have emerged of the former Air Corps member Lisa Smith, who's been posing with weapons just before she travelled to Syria to join ISIS. The pictures have been provided by associates of the former Irish soldier. They were taken on a farm in Tunisia in early 2013. They showed the Dundalk native posing with a rifle while wearing full Islamic dress. Smith, who travelled to Syria twice, spent nearly a decade with the Irish Defence Forces before converted to Islam and joining ISIS in September 2015. It's unclear if she fought during her time in Syria or if she became a member of the ISIS morality police, known as Hizbah. So that's on the front page of the Sunday Times. Sunday Business Post, budget boost for business as Donoghue prepares for no deal. Pascal Donoghue is set to unveil a range of budget tax incentives for businesses as he prepares for a potential rise of over €100 million in unemployment benefits due to a hard Brexit. The personal tax credit for the country's 300,000 self-employed workers is due to be increased, and the research and development tax credit is due to be changed to make it more attractive for small businesses. Both Leo Varadkar and Pascal Donoghue have been saying in the last 36 hours that any tax increases that are likely to be there will address anomalies in the tax system, so perhaps the discriminatory treatment of tax of the self-employed will come under that. Also on the front page of the Business Post, climate protesters are targeting the wrong people, say city retailers. Well, they would say that just before Extinction Rebellion tries to shut down the city for a week, wouldn't they? Environmental activists planning a week of disruption in Dublin risk alienating businesses and the public, a body representing 2,500 city centre firms has claimed. Richard Guiney, who's the chief executive of Dublin Town, says that businesses in the capital were already aware of their responsibilities regarding climate change and we're working to lessen their impact. Extinction Rebellion protesters will rally at the Dáil tomorrow before setting up a camp and blockading prominent streets throughout the week. Guiney, whose organisation includes retailers, restaurants and hotels, says the activists are misdirecting their anger as about 80% of people already travelled to the city centre in sustainable modes of transport. And finally now, for now, rather, the Irish Mail on Sunday. Corruption inquiry, GAA stars quizzed. This is by John Lee, political editor. This story is also on the Sunday Times, but John has it on the front page today. A group of GAA stars have been questioned in connection with an ongoing high-profile Garda corruption inquiry, the Irish Mail on Sunday can reveal. The questioning of the GAA players, all members of the same squad, was part of follow-up investigations into the alleged non-prosecution of offences. It's alleged that charges were not pursued regarding offences alleged to have been perpetrated by the players over an undetermined period of time. So that's on the front page of the Irish Mail on Sunday. That's a quick tour of what's on the front pages of the papers. I mentioned that we were going to play a little bit of audio from what Leo Varadkar had to say around Brexit last night. Here is a little bit of what Leo Varadkar had to say to reporters, including myself, when he was asked about whether it is still possible to get a Brexit deal before the big EU summit the week after next.
There is plenty of time for the UK government to put forward further proposals, and we're in the process of trying to arrange a meeting between me and Prime Minister Johnson next week. Time is tight. We have a European summit on the 17th and 18th of October, and it's not reasonable to expect 27 or 28 heads of government to sign off on something that they only see the night before or 2 days before. It's not the case that you can negotiate an international treaty at a council meeting in Brussels. You know, sometimes we might be able to come to agreements.
Is Friday a reasonable deadline?
I think Friday is reasonable, but, you know, these aren't going to be, you know, totally, absolutely rigid. Yeah, see, what I don't want to do is set a false deadline, and it's not for me to set that deadline.
So Leo Varadkar speaking to reporters last night, in which he said that there is enough time for there to be another deal, however, that time is tight, and then saying that this coming Friday would be an effective deadline for Britain tabling workable proposals, and then saying, though, that it's not up to him to set the deadline. So glad we straightened out all of that. In the meantime, this morning, Steve Barclay has been on the Andrew Marr Show on the BBC, and he's been responding to some of what Leo Varadkar said last night.
Can I start off by suggesting you have an Irish problem?
Well, the Taoiseach speaking last night said that that time is tight, but a deal can still be done. It's in both sides' interest to get a deal, and we have put forward very serious proposals, which I think people across the EU recognise, address many of their concerns and provide a broad landing zone in order for us to leave in a smooth and orderly way.
But it still seems an awful lot of people, in Northern Ireland in particular, that the British government does not understand their problems. Aidan Connolly, who's director of the Northern Ireland Retail Consortium, says the Prime Minister's long-awaited proposal is hugely disappointing. It's clear that he has not listened to the needs of Northern Ireland's business community or Northern Ireland households. And furthermore, a spokesman for Manufacturing Northern Ireland goes further. He says that these proposals would be worse for Northern Ireland manufacturers than no deal.
Well, it's true that many within Northern Ireland would prefer the option of the backstop or indeed as not leaving at all. Now, it is important that we leave. We honour the democratic result of the referendum. And the backstop is a unicorn that has failed to materialise three times in Parliament.
It's been rejected. It's not a unicorn, it's just been voted
three times. It's been rejected three times in Parliament. And the reason for that was the concerns around laws applying in Northern Ireland over which people would not have a say. And the fact that it was at odds with the Belfast Good Friday Agreement in terms of failing to secure this consent of both sides. That's why, Andrew, we brought forward the proposals on a regulatory zone, but with the crucial addition of consent in order to address the concerns that came up before.
So Stephen Barclay there on the Andrew Marr Show on the BBC this morning, suggesting that what has been put forward is a workable proposal, and that basically Kevin Doyle, Northern Ireland can't be part of a single market or customs union, given that it won't have any role in drawing up those rules, which seems like a logical proposition on the face of it.
Yeah, and the Brexiteers are now calling the backstop a unicorn, which is a fantastic turnaround of events, really, given that the backstop has actually got legal basis and appears to be workable, if only it were acceptable. I think what's most interesting there in Steve Barclay's thing, he's talking about this landing zone, which is a phrase that we've heard used a lot over the last year.
It's up there with direction of travel. Yeah,
and the problem with the landing zone is we all know where the landing zone is. We can see it, but nobody has a parachute. So we're hurtling towards it, but you're still going to smack into it. And listening to the Taoiseach last night, like, let's just get one thing straight, Gavin, because this is all utter rubbish. And there is not going to be a deal on the 31st of October. And people need to stop pretending that there is, because it's just not going to happen. Unless Boris Johnson accepts the backstop, which
is going to happen.
Which isn't going to happen either. So, because it's a unicorn. So this whole, you know, Lanigan's ball of in and out, there's a chance, but no, there isn't, but time is short, but there's plenty of time. It's completely pointless now. And it's just both sides afraid to be the one to put their hands up and go, it's over, boys. It's an extension or bust.
Jim McGrath, is that what it is? Is this basically just an elaborate blame game that both sides have to go through the charade of trying to square two circles, trying to bridge the gap, which is impossible to bridge, but that they're doing it because not doing it would mean then triggering the blame game of being responsible for the no deal?
I'm going to say pretty much, albeit I still think, you know, everybody around the table does genuinely want a deal. If a deal is in sight, nobody will kind of stop short of it. But if we just take a larger step back from this, and if we ask ourselves a question, why would there be a deal or A or B? Is it the case that the UK political system is capable of sustaining a deal and sustaining an agreement and a compromise?
Mm.
The answer to both of those things is no.
Well, you'd have to argue no, because even if Theresa May had gotten her deal over the line, if there were to be a change of government within, then Boris Johnson would have wanted to take in that deal, even if it had been inked and dried and settled and sent to the UN, and he'd want to tear it up again anyway.
Exactly. Look, I don't think at this point in time we can say that the other negotiating partner has a stable enough political consensus to sustain any kind of deal, no matter what it is. And it's interesting they're using the language this morning of unicorns on the backstop and all that. I mean, ultimately, what's wrong with the deal as currently proposed? They want to separate the single market regulations from the customs union in the north of Ireland. That's really tricky, because you actually use customs personnel and infrastructure to enforce the single market regulations. Like,
are one and the same,
like, pretty much. It's very difficult to see how that proposal is in any form workable. Now, if your starting point is that one side can't even bring forward something that is workable and practical, then it's very hard to see how there will ever be a deal. And maybe there'll be a point in this cycle when everyone will say it's in the best interest to just move this to the next phase of negotiations, and hopefully, and keeping that period of no deal as short as possible might be where this will end up. But instead of that, we'll have to go through about 6 weeks of high stakes political drama and a UK election to get us that far. But that's the direction of travel.
Siobhan Masterson, let me bring you in on this, because the proposition that was put forward by Boris Johnson this week, in effect, if Stormont were to play ball with it, Northern Ireland would at least be, it would be leaving the customs union, but it would at least be staying in the single market, which is more than can be said if there were to be no deal, because if there's no deal, then the entire UK, including the North, leaves both. At least with the present deal that's on the table, deeply flawed as Ireland clearly considers it to be, there would be the prospect of Northern Ireland at least staying within the single market. Would that not be preferable to you and your members, because at least it's less of an inhibition than you get with a no deal?
Yeah, so I don't think it's workable for Northern Irish business. This uncertainty is the problem. It's a killer for business. If you look at investment in the North over the last 3.5-4 years, it's nothing is happening. Companies, particularly the traditional manufacturing, are closing down. US investment is pulling out. 3.5 years of it, what they need now is certainty. And these proposals won't work. What needs to happen now is probably a move by the business community, which is already happening, to start looking at things on an all-island basis, on an all-island investment basis. But maybe just to come back to the earlier clip with Taoiseach Varadkar last night commenting on another deadline, and he's saying, well, it's not within his control. If you look at the current deadline, it was actually the French that set that deadline. So it was Macron that pushed for the 31st of October. So I don't buy that, nor does the business community. But certainly what we have to try and avoid is this continuous cycle of deadlines, which are unhelpful. They're short. They're not giving enough time. We need to step back. We need to let the British dynamic play out. And then at that point, go back in and try and hammer out a deal.
Is it not a contradiction to say that you want to, you don't want deadlines, so you want to stand back and let Britain work itself out? Because Britain isn't exactly going to become any more stable in the next 3 to 6 to 9 to 12 months. In fact, that you could argue that if businesses wanted certainty, then at least, you know, lance the boil of having the UK leave and get over it, and then at least you'd have certainty about what the reality is.
That could very much be what business wants at this point. Yes, but at some point there has to be a decision. Otherwise, it'll keep rolling on and on. And as we all know, this is slow motion. Yes, the weekly drama of, you know, British politics, I suppose, gives us a sense that something is actually progressing. But if you think back over the last 3.5 years, nothing has happened. The only thing that has happened is British politics has become more and more dysfunctional. And what was not acceptable 3 years ago is now, you know, entirely acceptable. The biggest threat two things. First of all, is inertia in British society that, you know, the general public have now become jaded and are disengaged from the political
cycle.
They
want to hashtag get Brexit done.
Yeah. And you know, I do think that Irish people are a lot more engaged in it because, you know, obviously the ramifications for our society and economy. But that's a big threat. The second thing that there's very little focus on, and this is an enormous risk for society and business, is the breakup of the UK. Conversations aren't happening around that. What does that look like? What does a push for Scottish independence mean for the North? What does that mean for the island of Ireland? Mm. All of those big questions. You know, in a way, I don't think we've seen anything yet.
You think that
in terms
all
of the last 3.5 years,
is compared to what's coming?
I think very possibly. And, you know, in a sense that the weekly drama that we're witnessing takes our eye off the ball.
Just on that, Gavin, we should remember we're in the easy part of the negotiations now. This is the separation. The trade deal, which is a lot more politically difficult, has to come.
I think Kevin Doyle and I just kind of locked eyes. we thought we'd been busy for the last 3 years. We've seen nothing yet. Kevin, on the point about the blame game or whether anything can be hashed out, I mean, obviously you've made your opinions pretty clear in the last few minutes. What's to be gained by Leo Varadkar going over and seeking more talks with Boris Johnson, as Philip Ryan is reporting on page 4 of the Sunday Independent this week, if you think that it's all a dead duck? Is it just a case of the choreography of trying to at least make it look like you want to drag a deal over the line? Because, I mean, if both sides stick to the positions that they are, as you've clearly indicated, there isn't going to be a deal. Boris can't go any further than he can without losing the DUP. And if he loses the DUP, irrespective of the parliamentary arithmetic, he's toast anyway.
Well, he loses the hardliners then within the Tory party who seem to be somewhat in awe of the DUP for whatever reason. Varadkar and Johnson agreed when they were in New York at the UN that they would meet again within a fortnight. So I suspect that Taoiseach has decided better to go ahead with that than to cancel it, because therefore once you cancel it, that in itself is an admission that nothing has happened. I mean, we're hearing that Macron and Merkel are refusing to meet with Boris Johnson before the European summit. And it kind of makes sense. There is this dynamic now where Europe is very much, all along it's kind of been Ireland led by Europe and the task force, but it has, and we saw it's the effort at the Telegraph and things like that. We saw pressure mounting on Dublin.
Yeah.
So, but there isn't pressure mounting on Dublin to cave, but there is pressure mounting on Dublin to lead the charge, I think, this time round.
So explain the difference then, so that they're not expecting Dublin to bend to get a deal, but what, they want Dublin to at least sort of informally take the lead in the talks?
Not so much take the leads in the talks, but at least be William Wallace, be out there on your horse in front. If Europe's going to take the hit for this, and if Europe's going to stand by you, well, you don't get to be the general who sits back and watches the first battalion go out and take the hit. So I think there is an element now that Leo Varadkar is going to be, we're going to see a lot of him over the next week. And obviously we have a budget and stuff domestically, but I think we're going to see him talking about Europe a lot over the next week, because I think he will be the largely the voice of it. And that's a very tricky position for the Irish government to be in, because it has been very handy to say we defer to Michel Barnier, or Mr. Juncker is taking a phone call from Steve Barclay's in Brussels. It's much more difficult when we have to be, because we see time and time again the Taoiseach gets turned into the boogeyman of Brexit. And that's very easy for the UK press to play with. So it's going to be a tricky 10 days for Leo Varadkar, I think, leading up to the European summit.
Yeah, and trying to juggle, as you said, trying to juggle all of that with the media obligations that surround doing a budget as well, because it's very difficult to stay out of harm's way and to try and play things deftly when you are required by the budget to be everywhere at all times. We're going to be seeing much more of Leo Varadkar this week than you do in many other weeks. Jim McGrath, do you think that there is the one thing that's ambiguous around all of this is that the UK is presenting these, and it seems to be speaking out of both sides of its mouth as to whether what it's put on the table now is the final offer, whether it's supposed to be the scope for a little bit of chat and maybe there could be tinkering. You know, Julian Smith, the Northern Secretary, has talked about maybe revising the rules of Stormont to address the perceived DUP veto. But it says that on one side of its mouth, and on the other side of its mouth, then it says, well, you know, these are our final offer, take them or leave them. And even some suggestions that Boris Johnson wouldn't even go to Brussels in a week and a half if the EU isn't prepared to play ball. Mm-hmm. So we kind of don't know whether, in fact, there's even scope to talk about these things or not.
And I think just what you're seeing there is the UK giving different messages to different audiences. It has one thing to tell its domestic press and its UK Brexiteers, and it has another message for the European Union. And that has been one of the issues that has bedevils this entire process. No, when they talk about a broad landing zone, I'm sure when they made those proposals, they would have priced in a negative EU reaction to it. But was it enough to start negotiations and maybe get it, and with the hope of getting into the famous tunnel that would have been spoken about? I also think they wanted to be seen to be reasonable as well to their own and prevent the post-Brexit blame game. There is some scope. There definitely, if there's one area where there is scope of negotiation, it is on the precise relationship of Stormont with the backstop. Mm. There is definitely room for manoeuvre there. Now, it's not the case that Stormont is, in EU terms, a regional assembly. No regional assembly can have a veto over EU law. That's not
outside of the EU.
That's not how the EU works. But if you actually were to flip one of the proposals on its head, which is the four-year proposal for to stay in this current arrangement, if you actually had a vote in Stormont to step out of the arrangement, notwithstanding the petition of concern, there is actually plenty and a consultative role for Stormont. There are things that you can do to improve the democratic accountability of the backstop within Stormont.
So you start with Northern Ireland then remaining, until it says otherwise, remaining a member of the single market, as opposed to the current plan, which is to leave but to opt back in again if it's convenient.
Because I'll tell you, if I was, Siobhan will probably articulate this better than me, if I was a Northern Irish business, I'd be much rather be doing business under a backstop arrangement than under this quasi two-border customs single market piece of business, which looks unworkable, looks burdensome. So at least if there is, I think there is scope for negotiation around that. But the wider piece of actually accepting the principle of checks on the island of Ireland is not something the Irish government should volunteer to do. If it ever does do it, it should be forced into it in a last minute.
And it will be forced into it because I was in Brussels at the start of this week. And one of the things I took away from talking to people who work in the background on these things, not the politicians, was that there will 100% be an expectation on Ireland. And it's not that they're going to be having months
to defend the single market.
And they're not going to have months or years to do it because, as one person put it to me, it's like back in March when we were originally supposed to have Brexit, we could have used the excuse of, oh God, this prepared. Is not what we never thought this was going to happen.
But it's 7 months on.
And 7 months on, that weakens. And I think there is no doubt that the EU will expect us to move reasonably quickly to have checks.
Which leads then to the question, Siobhan, I do have to take a break, but I want to kind of address this point first, that given that so much of what Ireland's been talking about for the last couple of months basically entails how are we going to deal with a no deal and reconciling ourselves to the prospect that there's probably going to have to be checks. Is it a certain amount of deft timing by Boris Johnson to say, well, if you guys are reconciled to checks anyway, you might as well do the checks in the context of an orderly withdrawal and a deal, rather than having to do checks in a scramble and a fight with Brussels in the context of a no deal? That if he says, well, Ireland is already kind of resigned to having to do something, we might as well do something, but also, you know, shake hands over it.
It's just so hard to read. I mean, I think the reality is if the UK does crash out, so if we don't have an extension on the 31st of October, which, by the way, I believe we will, if we don't, you know, trying to protect the single market is going to be a priority. And that brings as much pressure to bear on European ports as it does on Dublin, on Irish ports, right? So we will have your
Rotterdam and your Calais and the likes.
Absolutely. So we're going to see it across Europe. So it's not just an Irish problem, by the way. Now, we do have particular issues, and it will be very, very complex. But I do believe that we'll have some kind of temporary measures in place, but they will be also taking place in Europe as well. Just to say, Michael McDowell has a very interesting piece in the Sunday Business Post today, particularly around this dynamic between Prime Minister Johnson and the DUP. I think ultimately he can't shaft the DUP right now, right? He's got to wait till the next general election. And that's very important. So he may be forced to miss the deadline of the 31st. We may be into another extension period. But ultimately, I think that relationship between the UK and DUP is safe until the next general election. After that, it'll get very, very interesting. And so the general election is a key turning point. Yeah. But again, just to re-emphasise the point, I think all of what is going on is going to be one line in the history book, one line during this period. The chapter is going to be what happens post-Brexit.
Please don't reduce everything that Kevin and I have done for the last 3 years to one line.
Sorry.
It's so depressing. I just on your point around the EU possibly granting an extension, of course, there's every possibility that they will. But
I think they will.
But the argument has been made by Leo Varadkar and others that it would have to be presented with some sort of a game plan. And I think it's tenable that Boris Johnson could go in there and say, guys, I can't guarantee you a general election. Labour say they'll do it, but Labour have said they've wanted an election for so long and I can't necessarily guarantee you there's going to be one. So we'll park Brexit for now. But the other six-letter B word that's looming is the budget. We'll be talking all the problems that Pascal Donoghue has to deal with when we're back with the panel after this. Still joined by my panel in studio of Kevin Doyle, Siobhan Masterson and Jim McGrath, going through this morning's papers. Plenty, as you would expect, about the budget and how it's all done up. Before we talk about exactly what's in the budget and how it's going to be managed, Jim, you're a former special advisor to multiple ministers, so you've been on the inside of the tent when it comes to trying to figure out how budgets are done. Generally speaking, how late in the day can they go? Like, if the budget is still supposed to be delivered in 2 days from now, would you expect your department to sort of have its spending envelope, if you want to call it that, sort of nailed down at this point, or can things really go up to the last minute?
Pretty much. The tendency has been for the high spending departments to be done last. So it would be your social welfare and your Department of Health and then your areas of major political tension. Mm. So when you have Fine Gael and Labour in government together or a similar type arrangement, those very high level stuff might go literally to the last. And it might be the same with Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael at the minute. But 98% of the budget would be done. And if you really look at closely at the detail throughout the year, 95% of this budget is done in advance. All our EU requirements under the fiscal treaty, along with the proposals and the tax strategies papers and the summer economic statement, for the most part, the budgets are done long in advance, and it's only in the last days of final tweaks.
But I'm surprised at the idea that the biggest spending departments would be the last ones to nail down. I mean, I get that they've got more initiatives that need to be signed off on, but that if they occupy such a massive chunk of the public pot, you'd almost like to think that they'd be nailed down early so that the rest of the departments that are, you know, swimming in a smaller pool would know what they're going to get afterwards.
It's the other way it works. It's the departments that are swimming in the smaller pool get nailed down first, so that you actually, and it's often the case that the Department of Health is the actual last department ultimately sorted. Now, that's in terms of spending. Taxation might be operate slightly differently to that.
There was an example of that last year when on the Friday before budget day, there was a huge surge in corporation tax receipts.
Yes.
And the Minister for Finance made a decision to put that receipt into current health expenditure, which was kind of a surprise.
Which sounds sort of similar, Kevin, to what we had 2 days ago when we had the white paper and corporate tax going to be about another €1 billion over projections this year. And then suddenly, oh, look, the health needs a supplementary estimate. That'll be another €500 million disappeared.
Yeah, €320 million or thereabouts, I think, going into health as they're overrun this year. And we're saying that's OK.
Yeah,
that's
great. It's only half of last year.
It's only half of last year. Even though Pascal Donoghue, I remember standing in the room last year and Pascal Donoghue saying this can never happen again.
Yeah.
And now he's there going, but actually, this is great. It's half of what it was last year. And we're all supposed to move along because we can, because there's that big, massive chunk of corporation tax that we don't really know where it comes from coming in. We kind of just go, OK, grand. So, and it's a little bit like what we did with when housing was booming during the Celtic Tiger. And we was like, the stamp duty, sure, it'll never dry up. The corporation tax will dry up in the same way. And so we are on a very risky path. It'll get us through now. And with Brexit and all the rest, it'll get us through. But if something goes wrong, Brexit is an outside threat, if you like, but if something goes wrong internally in the way that it did at the last crash, we could be in serious trouble.
I'm going to get the three of you to talk about anything that jumps out from you in today's papers, and Kevin, I'm sure you've got a lot in the Sunday Independent you want to bring our attentions to, but just before we get to that, the way that Jim outlined the way the budget is drawn up, it seems to me that this had been a really low profile budget talks. I mean, obviously overshadowed by everything going on with Brexit, and then Fianna Fáil coming out on Friday morning and announcing that in fact there isn't the €700 million that Pascal Donoghue had advertised to play with. It seemed to the general tenor of the way they went about that, they were really digging in for a long weekend. It seemed to throw the cat among the pigeons that this is a lot less of a settled budget than they have been in years past.
Yeah, so two things going on there, I think, Gavin. One is that, yes, they're right. Loads of ministers underestimated what was needed for just to stand still.
Yeah.
So if nothing else changed, if Pascal Donoghue got up on Tuesday and said, we're just doing what we did last year, and that would cost X amount more because you have more pensioners, you have more people in the health system and all the rest. You have more public service wages for the people who've got the extra guards and teachers that came on this year. and that they underestimated how much all of that cost. And I'll give you one example, because obviously I went digging to try and find out what they were on about. One really simple thing that they seemingly miscalculated. So parental leave is coming in November, 2 weeks per parent. And seemingly they miscalculated and left out how much it would cost the government to pay for civil servants to take parental leave next year. And that's 22 million.
I'm sure I remember that Regina Doherty held up the introduction of that because she needed to clear it with the civil service and to make sure that the state was ready for that. And that was the reason why they delayed introducing it. And you're telling me that they actually never calculated how much it would cost.
There's 22 million apparently missing from next year's budget because they never put it in there. And that now will have to come from that 700 million, and that's how it gets reduced. But on the second point on this is that we have to remember that this is a pre-election budget, and therefore Fianna Fáil are out to undermine Fine Gael in every way that they can. Yeah. And we've seen the row recently where Fine Gael put out these videos going, Fianna Fáil looking for 4.5 billion euro. Mm. And it's all flashy and all over Twitter. And this is a real attempt now, I think, by Fianna Fáil as well to try to counteract that and go, look, sure, they don't even know how much money they have. How could you trust those guys? So there's a bit of electioneering going on.
Okay. Siobhan, we'll start with you then as regards to today's coverage. But obviously, the Sunday Business Post is pretty heavy on the supports that there might be there for business, and we hear talk of there being funds of up to 900 billion euro to support the sector. Is there anything in today's coverage that jumps out at you that you want to raise?
Yeah, I mean, if you look at Michael Brennan's piece in the Sunday Business Post, he leads with a piece called Budget Boost for Business as Donoghue Prepares for No Deal. And then in contrast to that, you know, the budget is being billed as kind of bland and boring. So there is this kind of mixed messaging coming from media around the budget. The budget is not bland and boring. It's probably the most strategic budget ever in a generation, right? Because of the kind of externalities we're facing in terms of the threats. The question is, how does government handle it? And I think corporation tax is key. And also to try to look at ourselves beyond Brexit. Again, coming back to my previous point, if you look at 80% of the coverage around the budget, it's all based on Brexit. We don't actually know the outcome of Brexit, right?
What Again, we do this is the know, certainty that you said we wanted.
But what we do know are other threats. For example, global tax reform. We know what's coming down the line in terms of the OECD tax reform proposals, that it may mean that it won't be as advantageous for Irish business as it has been in the past. And while we may have another year or two in terms of a surge in corporation tax, that may not continue forever. So how do we deal with that? Well, one thing we know that doesn't work and that is not sustainable is putting that income into current expenditure. What government should be doing is looking at productive expenditure, how it's going to insulate the economy in terms of what may be ahead of us, and to look at putting that fund, that income into productive spending. And what I mean by productive spending is investment in infrastructure, investment in the kind of areas that we're feeling rationed in terms of what's out there, you know, around education, childcare, housing, all of those issues, to address those issues now while we have these surges in corporation tax.
Jim, your thoughts on that or anything else you've seen in the papers?
I was particularly drawn to Conor Skeen's piece. It's the silence that's golden, where he simply articulates that actually there is some merit in bland and boring, to put it in those terms, and that actually when ministers are not using budget to generate headlines, it means they're not engaging in the type of short-term populistic behaviour that has actually gotten this country into a mess previously. And he also makes the point that actually there's no signs of overly stimulating the housing market. There are sounds of supply meeting demand. But just to pick up on the broader point that Siobhan has made, you can be both bland and boring and strategic at the same time. I think Brexit is being used to inject, a measure of fiscal discipline on government departments in this budget that maybe hasn't been there previously. And that's in order for us to have some buffer to increase spending in certain areas if Brexit goes really badly, as most of us around this table expect.
Bland and boring, by the way, is the editorial in the Sunday Business Post, and that Conor Skeen piece that Jim mentions is in in the Sunday Independent. I was listening to Vincent Wall's Taking Stock show just before I came in, and he had Brendan Keenan, a columnist with the Irish Independent, in. Kevin, I'll put this to you. He was saying that, you know, once upon a time, budgets were all about where the government was going to take money from you. There was, it seems that, you know, in the Celtic Tiger years, suddenly it became about where was money going to be given back, and that's become the default assumption that people have made, with the exception of the austerity years in between. We get to the difficult point now where obviously the state doesn't have as much money to play with, but it has these carbon responsibilities. It's got this commitment to carbon tax. And Philip Ryan's got this piece on the front page of the Sunday Independent this morning, suggesting that Fianna Fáil could backtrack on its decision to support carbon taxes. Now, surely Fianna Fáil, having explicitly voted for the inclusion of carbon taxes in this all-party report on climate change, couldn't possibly reverse ferret now and decide that carbon taxes are not to be introduced.
They might not reverse ferret, but they could stay very quiet and just let Fine Gael kind of swing in the wind on it. And I think that's the point of Philip's story. And I've spoken to ministers within Fine Gael who have the same fears. That basically you're going to hear a lot of mention of the All Party Oireachtas Committee next week, as the which didn't actually get all party support in the end.
Sinn Féin or the
and
other
the People
parties,
for Profit Solidarity, Rise, whatever they're called this week, didn't back the idea of carbon tax. But certainly, I mean, initially we had all assumed, if we go back a month ago, the assumption was that there'd be a 10 euro increase in the carbon tax.
Yeah.
Now we're down to talking to maybe 6-7 euro, and I think that's still being debated.
I heard at the Fine Gael Parliamentary Party that they sort of settled on 6 because they accepted that they had to do it, but that if it was going to increase by 60 euro over 10 years, then at least the way you had cover was to just do it in 10 equal increments.
Yeah, and so and we're going to get that trajectory on Tuesday as well, so we'll know going forward how much diesel and petrol and all the rest is going to cost every year in the back.
Could be a massive rural backlash to that, though, because I remember there was a piece, I was thinking it was in the Sunday Business Post, maybe the Sunday Times last week, explaining that it's all well and good for these to be drawn up in Dublin where most people have, you know, gas heating, but that there's 71% of homes in the border region that are still heated by, you know, your tank of oil in the back. And if that costs, you know, like 60 or 70 euro more to fill, you know, every year going onwards, then that, like, it's going to be a massive backlash, and that rural independent TDs are going to make a field day out of that.
Yeah, we still have turf in Offaly, you know,
for the time being at least, anyway.
Yeah. All the lettuce, but there is a big fear among some ministers, and this is kind of the offset of the urban ministers, which there are a lot of Fine Gael urban ministers, and some of the more rural ones. And one actually said to me during the week, it was like, it's fine if you punch a lad in the face, like, he'll get over that, but if you take a pound from his pocket, that's when he wants revenge. And so there is that kind of fear that that it will become a water charges thing. Now, I don't think it's going to be as vicious as that, because if it adds 2 cents to a litre of diesel, we're not going to be happy. But it's the kind of thing...
But budgets have done that in the past, and people get on with it.
It's the kind of thing you manage. But I had the story in the front of the Indo earlier in the week about how they're more worried about the home heating oil, the briquettes, the coal, that side of things, because how do you bring that in October, and we're heading into the winter? You can't. So do you wait till January? Well, you're in the middle of winter in January, so you're looking at May. But as you pointed out in your intro, you're in an election in May if we're working on, if we believe Leo Varadkar's timeline for when we're going to the polls. So I wouldn't be surprised if that was even put off until June, July, so second half of next year. And then
which has the argument that you're sacrificing the climate to save your political skin.
Exactly, and you're back into this debate. Like, they really missed out not taking the plunge on carbon last year. I think the opportunity was there, and if you know, there was no talk of Greta Thunberg, or there was no climate action protests from school kids at that stage, but they might have been ahead of the curve, but I think they've let themselves fall behind it.
Yeah. The aforementioned Brendan Keenan had a piece in The Independent on Thursday. The headline on it, Jim, was carbon tax too small to help the climate but too large for voters. And that could well be an easy political attack, because people would say that 6 euro is not going to save the planet, and in fact Ireland acting unilaterally can't save the planet anyway. But it could cost a lot of rural government TDs their seats.
It could indeed. And Leo Varadkar actually has his own piece in the Sunday Business Post where he talks about the importance of small nations taking leadership on this. And I suppose it comes back to that essential kind of point. How justifiable is it to tax people on something like carbon when there aren't viable alternatives for them? And that's true of rural households in that they don't have the same options that everyone else in the country might have to take a non-carbon based form of transport or form of home heating. So will there be a political backlash to this when it hits people in the pocket? I would definitely expect that. I think you're right, rural ministers rural independent TDs.
Well, rural ministers, Michael Ring is going to have a fun time sending this in mail, I'm sure.
And This is not the end of this. I expect the increase in the carbon tax to be as gradual and as incremental as possible. That will disappoint all the people of a more environmental persuasion. Is it going to dramatically influence our behaviour? It's not.
Mm.
And I don't necessarily, there's a major international debate as to whether carbon tax does really bring about the behavioural change that is actually required. Now, carbon tax on its own isn't going to achieve much, but can the government do that and manage the political fallout? Mm. I don't know.
And also, I think the solution here, and this is one of the big changes we've seen over the last few months in terms of the curation of the budget, is yes, a carbon tax is on the cards. Whatever the number they come down on Tuesday, the big change is how they're going to use that money. And now it's likely that they'll ring fence that money and put it back into
which they hate doing.
Yeah. And that's a big change.
Well,
in terms
the mandarins in the Department of Finance certainly hate doing that.
But that's critical to get over the political difficulties that government have, and also to try and deal with those who are most vulnerable in relation to the taxes, and that money is put back in to trying to support those who need it to innovate, to retrofit, to do all of those things. And the second point on that is this kind of trajectory of 10 years is also critical, because it comes back to that issue around certainty for business. And in the context of a very complex operating environment, just that certainty over a 10-year time period, what the hikes are going to be, is going to give that certainty to business around investing in sustainable methods.
I remember a rural independent TD telling me before that although it might be well and good and people might like the idea of taking some sort of climate action, when they realise that the hauliers who are going to have extra costs are going to have to pass that on to the cost of the groceries that they're delivering to your supermarket, that maybe people might change their minds about how supportive they are. We'll wait to see if that argument gets reanimated in the next couple of days. I want to take a quick break. There is another piece in the Sunday Independent by the Minister for Transport, Tourism and Sport, Shane Ross. He's making some pretty significant claims. We want to get to that when we're back after this. Welcome back, Gavin Riley with you on the record, still joined by Kevin Doyle, Siobhan Masterson and Jim McGrath. I want you to imagine, if you would, this is not the case, but I want you to imagine that the Minister for Health had written an opinion piece in the highest selling newspaper in the country, in which he accused a body which receives state funding through his department of a media campaign to blacken him, suggesting that they had covered some of his private expenses. They paid for him for dinners, they paid for him to go on travel and to trips abroad. You'd think that that would be actually a pretty phenomenal story. There's a piece to that effect on page 17 of the Sunday Independent, but Jim McGrath, because it's Shane Ross and because it's the FAI, people probably won't bat an eyelid, but he's making some pretty significant claims in this piece, isn't he?
Yeah, he's effectively saying senior people in the FAI are pretty much out to get him at the minute, and are using any negative details they have against him, briefing them to the media in order to generate coverage that's very negative for him. In fairness, it's a very well-written piece, and what he's done here is a great political tactic of look at these bad people, they're out to get me. Mm. And that's a long tradition in this country. Where it's slightly, I suppose, strange is that, you know, the FAI doesn't have a lot of credibility at the minute.
Yeah.
So being a victim of the FAI, of an FAI conspiracy, is, at least at this point in time, is not something that will bat an eye.
It's kind of a strange badge of honour, really, in a funny way, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. No, sorry, it is a well-written piece worth reading, but I'm just uncomfortable with the notion of a minister kind of portraying themselves as a victim in kind of this scenario. Look at those people out to get me. Yeah.
Do you not think that it's fair though, Kevin, on this, that, you know, this portrayal of a victim, because you know, last Sunday he came out and criticised the FAI's handling of the John Delaney resignation, which obviously was too late for most papers to get on the front pages last Sunday. Then he points out that on Monday morning the Sun newspaper went to work on a tip off. Somebody somewhere had told him that the FAI had paid my hotel bill after the Ireland versus Denmark match in Copenhagen back in 2017. They were on the money, the FAI had paid it all right. What the source never told the newspaper is that a result of a previous experience with the FAI, I had insisted, just in case anyone tried, that I should pay my own bill. Nor did the Sun's anonymous source tell the newspaper that when I found out what the FAI had done, I insisted immediately on reimbursing them. And he goes on to explain that when he went down to check out from the hotel, very keen to settle his own bill, he was somewhat incredulous to discover that the FAI had already settled it for him. He's got a point about how these stories come out, and I think the point still remains that if this were another minister with another body, we would all be paying much more attention to this.
Yeah, and it, like, it's the detail. It's actually fantastically well and colourful, well written and colourful piece, because, you know, he basically lays out how the FAI, he alleges, set a honey trap for him. That basically they wanted to pay for these things so that if he ever fell out with them down the line, as has happened, these stories would start to land and maybe he'd just shut up and go away and give them their funding and not be dealing with it. You're right. There is an element of... you know, we don't all take Boris Johnson very serious. Maybe we don't take Shane Ross very serious. Mm. But he has a point here. And, you know, there's a great line in it. And this maybe, again, is why we don't take these things so seriously, because it's Shane Ross and you kind of laugh a little bit. But like he talks about the recent FAI AGM and somebody told RTE that he was being wined and dined by delegates down at a dinner in Trim. Mm. And then he goes on in the second last paragraph, I've never been to Trim in my life.
Yeah. which is, as the designated Meath representative at the table, I think is an outrageous thing for the Minister for Tourism to say. It has a fine Norman castle that everyone should go and see.
It's just such a fantastic defence. I've never been to Trim, yeah. Never mind been wine
like,
and dine
but it's,
there.
It's not a million miles away from Dublin. Like, it's half an hour from the M50. I don't understand.
Okay, you can never focus, Gavin,
there.
On the story.
Okay, sorry. Siobhan, your thoughts on a minister using the platform of the country's highest circulating newspaper to vent his spleen about somebody saying nasty things about him?
Well, I think it's probably symptomatic of the way kind of global political leaders behave. You know, I suppose it's not a playbook that we're used to, that's for sure. I certainly don't think that a cabinet minister should feel the need to press release their innocence on such an issue in this kind of way. I think there are other ways that he could have done it. But that said, you know, he's got forum in this area and that's okay.
I actually disagree. I think he's right to write it. I mean, there is jiggery pokery going on here somewhere. So I think he's actually right to call them out on it, colourful language aside.
Jim, would you have advised previous ministers you worked with to go down this route, or would you have found some other dark arts way of correcting the record?
God, that's you would probably do some bit of both. You would try to create a platform. I would probably have put it as part of another set piece thing, in that you're doing something ministerial, it's positive, but actually, as everyone is here listening to me talking about this important ministerial thing, I'd like to set the record straight on these facts, rather than actually donating a full column to it, which makes it seem like
cynical about politicians.
Which makes it seem like a petty row between two people, whereas there's actually at the heart of the FAI and the corporate governance issues and its relationship with government is actually a much more serious issue, and this diminishes that somewhat.
Have you been to Trim?
No, don't think I have. Yeah.
Siobhan, come on.
I'm sure I've driven through it, but I haven't actually gone there to do something.
Kev, come on, help me out here.
Yeah, no, I've been there quite
okay,
a few
good,
times.
Right, okay,
there's a nice hotel there, isn't there?
There's the Knightsbrook Hotel, which I think is where the FAI AGM was. There's the Trim Castle Hotel. There's lovely things to go and see in the constituency of Meath West. I'm amazed, actually, that Damien English has allowed Shane Ross to be the Minister for Tourism for 3 years and never bring him to Meath West. We're going to have to let my personal grievance about tourism in Meath West lie there. Thank you all for your time this morning. Great to have you all with me. Kevin Doyle, Group Political Editor at Independent Newspapers, Siobhan Masterson, who's the Head of Corporate Affairs at IBEC, and Jim McGrath, Public Affairs Director with Teneo Ireland. Thank you all very much for joining me.